morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at KSFR. We are also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the program any time of day, made possible by DotFoil Computer Services on the web at dotfoil.com. Later in the program, Robert Knott will be with us, as he is every Friday, speaking of the arts. Right now, I'd like to welcome Marianne Golan. She is director of photography at Time Magazine, and she is here in Santa Fe to participate in a forum called The Ethics of War Photography, which is tomorrow, April 14th at 7 o'clock at the forum at the College of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Now, this is a huge job, director of photography, picture editor at Time Magazine. And I was thinking about it. I was looking at Time Magazine on the web, and I've been looking at it anyway lately. How do you work with the print, the written word? Are you illustrators? When you do photography for Time Magazine, are you illustrating articles? Are you working collaboratively with the writers who write articles?
We're working collaboratively. It's a team effort, the magazine, and we both do visual journalism that has absolutely nothing to do with the words in a way, because it's stories told in a visual way, but we also illustrate stories. It's a complete collaborative effort. The editors and the photo editors and the art directors meet together every day, and we talk about what are the important stories of the week, the important stories of the month, and we are planning ahead and planning what we're closing on the week we're closing. But it's very, very much a collaborative effort.
Do they have, do writer journalists have the same respect for photojournalists as vice versa?
Well, they should. in this day and age especially, because we've become such a visual society that the photojournalists sometimes work together with writers. We have teams that work very well together and particularly connected to the College of Santa Fe. And my panel tomorrow with Thomas Dvorak, we have a team in Baghdad that's been working there since before the war even. And they have to work together naturally because of the difficulties and dangers of the circumstance. But that's sort of a special case.
Right.
You know, in normal times, sometimes a reporter will work completely independently of a photographer. They'll go out and report a story and interview subjects, and then we'll come behind them and do photography. Or we can have it exactly the opposite way around. A photographer can come with really wonderful work, and a reporter can go behind the photographer. So sometimes they work as a team, and sometimes they work separately.
So you must have to assign photographers to certain jobs. Do you make teams? In other words, oh, this writer works very well with this photographer, or this photographer is very good at that kind of assignment?
Yeah, I think it's more about the photographer and the assignment than it is about what writer and photographer would work well together, because there are different kinds of stories require a different kind of eye, and professional journalists have strengths and weaknesses in different kinds of stories in different kinds of areas, and I think we look for the person that we feel will bring the most visually to the subject matter or to the, you know, to the individual, because we do portraiture, we do photojournalism, we do a lot of different kinds of photography.
So there is this huge movement where a lot of people have taken cameras into their own hands because the technology is so cheap and because we have the internet and people are publishing things on YouTube and every third person has a blog and so on. How has that proliferation of photography affected professional photography?
I don't think it's really changed. It's interesting because I think if you look at the history of the Pulitzer Prize, which is the leading photojournalism prize for newspapers in America, if you look at the history going all the way back to the beginning of photography, more than half of the winners of the Pulitzer Prize have been amateurs, because they have just been somebody in the right place at the right time who managed to capture something that was really historically important. That's never going to change. What's changed is the technology. It used to be that you had no way to get your picture out there if you were an amateur. You know, you just, oh, I have this amazing picture, let me show my friends. Now you can put it on the web, and thousands or millions of people can see it. So I think it's more about everybody can be a photographer because they can put up their pictures on, they can upload them, people can look at them. But if you do a random look at all the images on the internet, a lot of it is clearly not anything that you should be wasting your time on.
Well, I mean, just the proliferation of images alone is something that does affect people, or must affect people. I mean, I remember when I was a young college student, I went to Italy for a semester, and I went to a church where there was a mural of the life of St. Francis of Assisi, and I was thinking, this is the only image that anybody in this town ever sees if it's the year 1423. Now we have images really coming out of our eyeballs to where we're overloaded. What does that overload do to people?
I think that I can't speak for people at large, but I think one of the things is it opens the world. I mean, it makes the world a whole lot smaller. I think it's wonderful. I think the technology is wonderful. I think the fact that everybody can share their photography is wonderful. But I don't know. It's funny. For years, people have asked me, "Oh, you must look at so many pictures. You must look at so many pictures." And I say, "Of course, I do. I'm an editor. You know, I look at thousands and thousands of pictures." And there are times where, depending on the subject matter, it can be overwhelming even for me, and I'm a professional. So I'd say it'd be hard for me to answer the question for an average person. For me, it's fantastic. I mean, it's a whole new world of opportunity, even as a photography editor and as a photojournalist, to be able to access imagery. The tsunami is a perfect example. During the tsunami, not during the actual hitting of the wave, but during the tsunami, we were approached by so many people who were on vacation, who were there, who had imagery, and it was amazing treasure trove of pictures that, unless we'd had a team of reporters on the ground in the olden days, you know, we would never have been able to, you know, recoup all that material. So it was a wonderful thing to be able to access on the spot fantastic imagery from people who were there and witnessed, you know, something of that kind of magnitude.
And another point that I've actually heard you make is that people who have a talent for photography are now able to get into it and be professionals at a young age because they don't have to be wealthy and come from a wealthy family and buy expensive equipment and have an expensive college education.
Yeah, maybe it's opened it up a little bit. I still feel like photojournalism's in trouble in America. I feel like besides the newspapers and Time and a couple of other outlets, photojournalism has been slowly dying because we're in a sort of environment of celebrity journalism now, and everyone wants portraiture, and everyone wants to see their favorite star, see their, you know, they want to see the people they care about, only the people they care about. Now, I'm not...
Has it ever been different?
I think it has been different, because I think there was a time when we weren't so isolated in that complete culture of Hollywood and celebrity. You know, it's funny, in America, it's harder than it is in Europe or in other places because there, you know, your next door neighbor is a different country. So there's an openness to other cultures and other ideas. But I feel like photojournalism is a way, it's a window on places we can't go. It's a window on societies we can't understand. And especially when it's done by a professional with integrity and thought and training. It's something that we really should lose.
We're talking to Marianne Golan. She's the director of photography at Time Magazine, and she's going to be tomorrow at the College of Santa Fe at the Forum in a panel discussion on the ethics of war photography, which is something we can get into in a few minutes. I was looking last night at the covers of Time Magazine, which are archived on the web since 1923. It's hilarious. It's very interesting. How, at this point in history, is the cover image decided?
Well, it's, again, a team. We're not exactly a democracy. It is run by an editor and an editor-in-chief. And ultimately, the decisions about what cover image out of the choices of cover images we have each week is decided by the editor and the editor-in-chief. But there's a small group of people who are working together with the editors of the story, whatever the story of the week is, whatever we've decided is cover-worthy. And we work through different ideas and different cover lines and different images, and ultimately the decision is made by the editor and the editor-in-chief.
Now, You're a woman director of photography. Are you the first one at Time?
No, I'm the second.
You're the second. Because one of the things that struck me when looking at these covers, I mean, I started in the maybe 40s or 50s and kept going, you know, by five-year increments. Men, just portraits of men. And then an occasional woman who was either a woman in a bathing suit or Jackie Kennedy. Basically.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you get into the 80s and you've got a little Princess Diana thrown in. And I was amazed. I mean, I was thinking, oh, this is going to start shifting in the 70s. I mean, there'd be pictures of space, pictures of a, you know, planetary body or something. But it really is very recent that the covers have opened up to being not just portraits of essentially men in politics.
Yeah, it's true. But the magazine, our strength, it really is politics. I mean, we're a magazine that covers the nation and the world and economy and business. And if you look at the nation and the world and economy and business, you'll see that it's mostly run by men.
That's so true.
It's sort of natural that we've moved away. There was a time when we did a lot of music, what we call back of the book covers. You know, we did a lot of music, we did trends, we did different things like that. But I think as the market has proliferated with different things, what Time is able to do now is to bring our expertise. And our expertise really is at making sense of the world to people. And when I say the world, I mean America, but also the world. And politics are still very much dominated by men. So we laugh about it sometimes where, you know, you have a whole cover story of a bunch of white guys in ties, but it's kind of the power structure. So it's interesting that we've moved away. When you talked about going through the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, it's around the 70s that it started to change. I arrived at Time in the 80s, so I've been there over 20 years. And it's still something we think about, you know, like how to be more, you know, have more women, have more, you know, diversity. But we're really reflecting the society and covering the society. I mean, we're a journalistic organization, and our specialty is politics. So.
Right, right. Now, you left Time magazine in, I believe it was 1996, and came back a few years later. Mm-hmm. Why did you leave?
Well, I went to U.S. News & World Report to work with James Fallows, who is a fantastic writer who took over the magazine there, and I really wanted to work with him. And also I was offered a position that was a higher position than the position I was in, so I moved to Washington and had a great ride for about 2.5 years with Jim, trying to remake the magazine, try to redefine the group, the sort of news magazine group. And when you look back on it now, I mean, that's 11 years ago. He was way ahead of his time, because what we're doing now at Time, you see it in Time, in some of the other publications, is exactly what he was trying to do 11 years ago. It was just he was a little too early. But I was very, very, very lucky in that I left Time in 96, and when Jim left the magazine, U.S. News & World Report, Time invited me, and I'll quote, to come home. So I came back to the magazine. I was very lucky.
Tell us about what your day was like on 9/11/2001.
Whoa. I had a rough day, like all of us did. But I was at home, and I live in New Jersey. I commute into Manhattan every day. And I was at home when the first plane hit the World Trade Center. And my boss, who at that time was the director of photography, I was the picture editor, was on vacation in Maine. And she called me, and she goes, "Can you believe what's happened?" And I didn't even have the radio on. And I said, "What's happened?" She said, "A plane hit the World Trade Center." And I said, "Bye." I like hung up the phone and flew out the door. And I had my cell phone and my son's cell phone. And I started getting on the phone. I just started working. I didn't even think about the ramifications of it. I just knew I had to work. And I had to take a very circuitous route to the city because they closed all the entrances. And they closed all the entrances to the city. So I had to go a very long way to get there, and only made it as far as the Broadway Bridge, and then had to walk about 100 blocks and ended up getting to my office in an emergency vehicle. I saw somebody loading oxygen tanks into the back of a taxi. I'm not a taxi, an emergency vehicle, and convinced him to drive me the rest of the way. And when I got into the office, it was already about 11. You know, so everything had happened. I mean, the planes had hit, the buildings were down. I remember that my first telephone call, though, which I think is probably the best thing after I hung up from Michelle's, I gotta go, bye. Ran to my car, but my second call was to my sister, who lives about five blocks away from the World Trade Center, and I said, you got to get out of there. She goes, what was it? Because she heard this noise. And I said, it's a terrorist attack, and you've got to get out of the area. Where's Dennis, her husband, you know? And she said, he's in Brooklyn. I said, call him, get him back. So he drove back and picked her up and her children, and they literally picked up neighbors and stuff and drove the wrong way up Greenwich Street, away from the cloud, you know. But she said, thank God you called me, because, you know, she didn't even know what was going on. She only lived six blocks away. But anyway, the magazine decided in 36 hours to put out a special edition. It's the only time in the history of Time Magazine that we did a black-bordered magazine, because the magazine's defining characteristic is its red border.
Right.
And it was such a dark day for America and everything that had happened. And we just stayed up for about 48 hours. You know, it was 36 hours to the close, but then we closed a second magazine 3 days later. But we tried to take in thousands and thousands of images, and we were incredibly lucky to have James Naughtway, who's one of the, inarguably, in my opinion, greatest living photojournalists, who was in town and actually had walked over and started photographing it almost as it was happening. So we had an amazing set of pictures, and we did 30-some pages of photography and one continuous story to tell everybody what had happened. And that was very unusual for us, because normally it's 7 days for us to put out a magazine. We did it in 36 hours. And I think nobody really got to process anything, because we were so busy working, you know. And it's sort of like whenever any really bad thing happens, I guess most people who aren't journalism professionals think, oh my God, this is a horrible thing, and they're busy processing it as it happens. And for me, it all comes like way later, you know, because I just think about what we have to do and what our responsibilities are to our readers. And so it was a difficult time.
Have you ever been or have known photographers who have been in a situation where they're photographing something, but there was an instinct to actually help because somebody was in trouble? So in other words, having to make a choice between helping somebody and photographing them?
Yeah, I think there's a point at which, I mean, it's not something that I can answer, because it's not something that I've personally had to do, because I was a photographer before I was a picture editor, but I was never in the sort of circumstance where you had to help. But I think I can quote some of my colleagues who've said to me over and over again that their job is to record. I mean, if somebody was dying in front of them and it was the difference of them pulling their arm up or something like that, they would definitely put down their camera and do so. But, you know, for instance, you brought up 9/11. There were thousands of rescue workers that were in the area, and the photographers did what their job is, which is to record what was happening there, to, you know, make a visual record. And one of the saddest things about what happened immediately following the destruction of the World Trade Center was that they shut all the photographers out.
What's up with that? I mean, and Katrina is perhaps an even more egregious example of that. Is, I mean, we do have First Amendment rights, freedom of the press. That includes presumably photography. On what basis are photographers shut out, and what happens? You know, what do you think of that?
Well, I think it's wrong, and I think that there's a fear factor that immediately comes in, that somehow, I don't understand it really. The New York Times led the effort to try to get professional photographers let back in to what was, you know, known almost immediately as ground zero after the World Trade Center incident. But what ended up happening was people had to go in, professionals, had to go in as rescue workers, you know, and the people who had been there at the very first could get back in, and nobody knew was allowed to come. There's one photographer who, I don't know how he managed it, but was allowed to use professional equipment, but we ended up using pictures from lawyers, from doctors, and we kept making the argument, do you understand what you're missing here, to not have professionals be able to work? During Katrina, it was egregious, but not for us, because luckily we had a couple of people there early, and they were able to continue to work, and we were able to successfully argue that the recording of what was going on there by professional photographers was important. I mean, for history, it's important. But also, I guess what I think it is that there's some fear. There's some fear of, you know, having uncontrolled, you know, access.
Democracy.
Yeah, yeah, there's a fear of that.
We're talking to Marianne Golan. She's the director of photography for Time Magazine. There's a, you know, many things which I think will come up tomorrow during the forum that you're doing at the College of Santa Fe. And, of course, the we don't have time right now to get into the whole question of embedded reporters, but that's an issue that, that you've come across and that everybody working in photojournalism has to deal with. But what kind of relationship do you have, I mean, in Katrina, in 9/11, and certainly in Iraq, you have a relationship with government personnel one way or the other, whether they be law enforcement, whether they be military, or whether they be people breathing down your neck saying, for national security reasons, you can print this but not that. What's that like for you?
Well, each situation is different.
What's the one that's bothered you most in terms of, maybe the word is too strong, but censorship, people telling you what
to
do.
Well, the first Gulf War was worse. I mean, it's really interesting because from the inside, I think people's idea that embedded reporters are somehow less legitimate than free-roaming reporters. But if you look back at the history of war photography, and especially the first Gulf War, that was the most egregious form of censorship ever. And that was when the Allied forces, and it really was an Allied force, were trying to free Kuwait from the grasp of Saddam Hussein. And they completely censored everything. The military had to look at every picture. It was still film. So they had a level of control that in 2007 they...
You don't have with digital
no
photography.
Way. Yeah, because all you need is a sat phone and you can upload your pictures. But this was, you know, it had to go back to a central place, had to be processed, had to be... And everything was looked at. And I remember being so angry, so angry, that when they came up with the idea of embedding photographers and writers with groups, I said, okay, well, this makes sense, because A, they can't be separate from them. If they're separate from them, they could be killed. They could be in mortal peril. But embedding them gives them the opportunity to get to know the people that are there. There's a level of trust that grows between the journalists and the reporters. But we had people both embedded and in Baghdad, and the censorship level was much higher in Baghdad. And there was some sort of, in America in particular, idea that there was more legitimacy to the photography coming out of Baghdad than there was the photography coming out of the embedded journalists.
And at the same time, the whole thing of embedding was that journalists had to sign contracts. And, you know, I mean, the military themselves admitted that this was part of what they called information warfare.
Yeah, but the contracts that they signed, really there was only one restriction. One was that they couldn't upload to satellites if they were in an area where they thought it was going to endanger the group. So in other words, if the satellite communication could be, okay, that's just common sense. The second part was that they would not release photographs of dead or wounded before the families of the military were able to be contacted. This seemed incredibly reasonable to me.
Now, that brings up a very interesting point, which is that the European news media and the American news media do seem to have a different standard of what they're going to print in terms of wounded Iraqi children, missing arms in hospitals and things like that. There's a lot more of that type of imagery in Europe than there is in the United States. There's your lone picture here and there, but we do not really show the casualties and the horror of war in Iraq here the way we do there. Where do those decisions come from?
Well, I can't speak for the whole American media. I think that at Time Magazine we've been at the forefront of showing imagery that's painful to look at. We've had a lot of readers be very upset by the kind of imagery we've published in the magazine.
And they think that you shouldn't publish it? Or?
Well, they just think that it's not something they want to see. They don't want it on their coffee table. I immediately think of a picture taken by a Russian photographer who's a contract photographer to Time, so he has a formal relationship with us, of a little boy called Ali. And his entire family was killed in a rogue bombing incident. And we ran a photograph of the little boy in his hospital bed with his distant aunt, the only member of his family they could find, you know, touching his head. And his body was horribly burned, and he had no arms. And the publishing of that photograph led to an international effort to, you know, save him, but also to put together a fund to help with the children. So I feel like I can't speak for the whole media, but I can certainly speak for the magazine in that we've made painful decisions. We've made decisions to run pictures that I'd say were shocking in order to show the circumstance there. We've also had an incredible commitment that we've never moved away from at Time Magazine, which is to continue covering this conflict, no matter how difficult it becomes. So we have a bureau there. We've really invested in keeping our readers informed.
And that's an example of where a picture is worth a thousand words. I mean, those are the pictures that really touch people's hearts and inflame their passions. Marianne Golan, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much for having me.
Marianne Golan is Director of Photography at Time Magazine, and tomorrow, the 14th of April, she will be at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe at 7 o'clock in an event called Witness the Ethics of War Photography, and this is part of the Ethical Dilemmas series at the College of Santa Fe. I believe that these events are all free and open to the public, and you're going to be there with another photographer, Thomas Dvorak. And so they will all be there. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now, and when we come back, we'll be speaking with Robert Knott. Stay tuned to KSFR.
KSFR programming is underwritten in part by the Santa Fe Farmers Market. The Farmers Market reminds you that it is moving to the parking lot of DeVargas Center for its 2007 outdoor season beginning Saturday, April 21st. Until then, the indoor winter market is open every Saturday from 9 to 1 at El Museo Cultural through April 14th. Call 983-4098 or visit SantaFeFarmersMarket.com for more information. The Farmers Market is a tax-exempt organization.
Outpost Productions and Padmini continue their celebration of Padmini's 10th anniversary with a much-anticipated concert event featuring the legendary tabla virtuoso Zakir Hussain and India's greatest living santur player, Pandit Shiv Kumar Sharma. Tuesday, April 24th, 7 p.m. at the Lensic in Santa Fe. For info, call 268-0044 or visit outpostspace.org. This message sponsored by Outpost Productions, a tax-exempt organization. The legendary Rio Grande is a river runner's paradise, a trophy trout stream, and home to great flocks of sandhill cranes. It is also threatened by mismanagement and over-appropriation. The Sierra Club invites you to hear Steve Harris, Director of Rio Grande Restoration, explain how we must be stewards of our endangered river on Tuesday, April 17th at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Church in Santa Fe on the corner of Galisteo and Barcelona. This message sponsored by the Sierra Club, a tax-exempt organization.
And I'd like to welcome now Robert Knott. He is the associate editor of the Pasatiempo Friday Art Supplement in the Santa Fe, New Mexican, and he's here with us today, as he is every Friday, speaking of the arts. Welcome, Robert.
Well, the weather outside is frightful, but never shall it so delightful. And since we've nowhere to go, let it snow, let it snow. Hey, lady, how
hey,
are
it
you?
Stopped snowing.
It just stopped just now as I began to sing.
But there's a cute doggy coming in the door, so it's all okay.
Doggies are wonderful in the snow. They love the
it's
snow.
It's an assistance dog, just so that if animal control is listening, they don't have to come and shut us down. It's
I hope
a legitimate dog.
Me. I have to deal with you every Friday. We just got word that I was gonna announce the video about Diego Rivera's labor legacy, the Detroit murals, the video being shown Tuesday night.
But that's been put off.
Canceled or postponed, so
postponed.
It's not happening. It's not happening, but I was
it's happening
planning
in
to
June.
Announce it. Before we talk about real arts, let's talk about cinema. A fun
cinema's
little,
not real?
Well, it is when it's film. But when it's a movie, that's something totally different. Fired at the Film Center. Go see it. It's fun. I wrote a column about it today. It's a really fun picture by Annabelle Gurwitch, who people still probably remember from Dinner and a Movie on TNT. She got fired by Woody Allen in a play about 5 years back, and depressed her, as this often happens with most of us who've been fired. I tell a little story about being fired in my column, and she made a movie about it, and it's a fun little 71-minute documentary. It's really pretty good, and it runs for 4 or 5 days at the Film Center. Meanwhile, at CCA, Tears of the Black Tiger. What a bizarre picture. A little musical, a little Western, a little Douglas Sirk melodrama from the 50s. It's strange, and it's Taiwanese with English subtitles. It's there. I sort of like it and sort of don't get it, but it's definitely visually interesting, and it's at the CCA. And then Grindhouse, talking about non-artistic but lots of fun movies. A double feature of B-retro raunch pictures made by Robert Rodriguez and Quentin Tarantino. Playing at, I think, DeVargas, and there's a review in there in today's paper by myself and Rob Benziker. We went to see it together. So it's a fun weekend for movies if you want to go see stuff. Don't go see The Reaping. It's terrible. I like horror movies, but it's bad. I don't know what's going on with Hilary Swank. She's making all these bad pictures. Do you like her as an actress?
What have I seen her in? I can't remember.
Million Dollar Baby, Boys Don't Cry. She's been in some bad pictures lately. Mm-hmm. But she'll probably have a comeback in a couple of years.
Let's hope so, for your sake.
Well, I mean, why you? There's a big show at the Palace of the Governors for all you Beat people. Jack Kerouac and The Writer's Life. They're gonna present the original scroll that he wrote on the road.
I love this. Sacred Scrolls of the Beat Poets.
Yeah, and it's opening tonight with a reception that I'm pretty sure is free. It is free, 5:30 to 8 p.m. Where at? The Palace of the Governors, 105 West Palace Avenue.
You know what that scroll is all about.
Yeah, there's a great story in today's Pasta Tempo by Soledad Santiago about that scroll. But
Jack Kerouac typed on a typewriter, which is all they had in the old days. And now it's, I suppose, our computer word processing systems are virtual scrolls. But at that point, he put, instead of separate pieces of paper in the typewriter, it was just one long, endless roll of paper and just typed and typed in that stream of consciousness way that On the Road is all about.
It's 120 feet long.
Yeah.
So I don't know how much of it they'll show, but I hope it's a lot. So that's our cover image in the Pasta Tempo. Great work by our graphics artist, Marcelo Sandoval. And there's three stories in Pasta today about this, about him, about the scroll, and then Paul Weideman did a little story about music of the Beat Generation. So there's a lot of fun stuff happening at the Palace of the Governors. Go there this weekend. I will give you a phone number. 476-5100. Tonight is free. I'm going to go. I'm also going to try to go to Fine Arts for Children and Teens, which is a great organization. I've covered them many times, and I think the world of them. Providing art for kids and teens, and that is so vital to making a difference in their lives, a positive difference. And they are having an exhibition tonight at the gallery at Wells Fargo Bank, which is on Washington Avenue, not far off of Paseo de Peralta. Fine Art for Children and Teens Spring Student Art Exhibition, reception 4 to 6. So you go there at 4, and about 5 o'clock you wander over to the Palace of the Governors. And that exhibition will be up at the Wells Fargo Bank, 241 Washington Avenue, through April. Another exhibition I'm going to tonight, if I can, is Women Who Shot the 20th Century. It's a group show of photos at Monroe Gallery of Photography, also downtown, so you can do all three of these tonight. 112 Don Gaspar Avenue. They have great photo images in there. And we have a terrific story in today's PASA about these female photographers from 30 and 40 and 50 and 60 years ago whose work will be on display tonight at Monroe Gallery.
Well, that's sort of a theme of the day is photojournalism. We were just talking to the director of photography at Time Magazine.
She was a great interview. That sounded terrific. I was listening to it. I stayed out there in the snow and listened to it on my car radio.
Yeah, a lot of very interesting issues that come up with that. I mean, it's a tricky job. I mean, you get thousands and thousands of images, and you have to choose one for each story.
It was interesting to hear her talk about the potential decline of photojournalism and her reasons for it.
Yeah, I wonder about that because we always talk about how great the olden days were, but I mean, you're the first person who would talk about pinup girl celebrities and things like that.
Ha-cha-cha-cha. But you had a great point when you said, you know, aren't we being overstimulated, isn't it? There's so much imagery at us that I don't think we are taking the time anymore to contemplate what most of it means. But you could probably have a good panel discussion about that. Do we want to reiterate for people that just tuned in about that particular...
Yes, that's at the College of Santa Fe. It's called The Ethics of War Photography, and it's tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Forum at the College of Santa Fe.
Free.
Free, free, free.
And she will be there along with a few other people, and I'm going to give you a phone number, 473-6282.
Hey, tomorrow also from 1 to 3 in the Franklin Miles Park at the corner of Seringo and Camino Carlos Rey is a rally called Step It Up, which is about step up the campaign to do something about global warming.
That's right.
And they are having, and I'm going to this, a light bulb trade-in. You bring in an incandescent bulb, and for each bulb that you bring, they'll give you a 100-watt equivalent compact fluorescent bulb, which those things last 10 years, and it's quite a deal.
This is very funny. There's a little brief in the New Mexico. Sorry to do this. The city has decided it won't send light bulbs that are exchanged during a Saturday climate change awareness to the Habitat for Humanity Restore for reuse.
Yeah, that would rather defeat the purpose, wouldn't it?
Yes, but... all right, I'm getting back to the arts every time I put a... I remember I tried to read that story about the rooster in you. Okay, if you were ever interested in climbing Shiprock, do you know anything about Shiprock?
Yes, it's a rock that's shaped like a ship, and it's in the Shiprock area of northwestern New Mexico.
There is a slide lecture on Saturday, just in case you wanted a little more relevant information, from 5 to 6 p.m., on climbing Shiprock at the Travel Bug Coffee
Why
Shop.
Why are you giving me hassle?
I'm not. I'm just reading. I'm not hassling you. I'm just... there I go. I ask a simple question. I get a good answer. Marks on paper. M-A-R-K-S. That kind of marks. Not Groucho Marks.
Who's Mark? And why is he on paper?
This is what I'm reduced to now. I've become the...
Look, you did the same thing to me, and you've been doing it for 2 years solid, so I don't want to hear anything about it. Well, talk about Mark.
Marks on Paper is a group show of works on paper. It's about people that make marks. It's a reception from 5 to 7 p.m. tonight at the Zane Bennett Contemporary Art Gallery at 826 Canyon Road. And while we're at it, there's also an exhibition at El Museo Cultural de Santa Fe. Los Niños Ven La Luz, Children See Light, photos by Capitol High School, Monte del Sol Charter School, and Boys and Girls Club students. This is going to be a good exhibition. Also great to go see it tonight. Reception 5 to 7, free, at El Museo Cultural, 1615B, Paseo de Peralta. The show runs through April.
I know a boy named Mark. Hey, there's a Cat of the Week. Well, actually, the Cat of the Week has probably been adopted, but there are cats of all kinds at Felines and Friends, and there are mobile adoptions. The next one is this coming Sunday at Petco from 12 to 3 in the afternoon, and they are always looking, aside from people who would like to adopt these marvelous cats. You're purring, Robert, not. I thought you were a dog person. Aside from looking for people to adopt these marvelous cats, they're also looking for caretakers and cage cleaners. So you can call Felines and Friends at 316-CAT-1.
Here, kitties. Here's a show for you, Laid Bare. Now, before you comment or raise your eyebrows, it's contemporary landscapes in New Mexico and Arizona. It's not news. Paintings by Martha Kennedy. Reception tonight, 5 o'clock at Artistas de Santa Fe, 228B Old Santa Fe Trail. Bring your cat. There is a good lecture tonight by Samuel Cutler, The Republic of Letters and Numbers. It's a lecture on which books we read and why. Now, I don't know how this guy sums it all up. I don't know if he knows about my book collection.
Which books we read and why.
Keep under my bed. 8 p.m. tonight, Great Hall Peterson Student Center. St. John's College, 1160 Camino Cruz Blanca, no charge.
Hey, have you talked about the Middle Eastern music concert at the Rail Yard tomorrow night?
No, go ahead.
Music and dance concert and open dancing at the Rail Yard, and that's tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. Surin Baronian and Haig Manukian, who haven't been to New Mexico for a while, and they are magnificent Middle Eastern musicians. One plays... well, all sorts of instruments, clarinet, saxophone, duduk, and Arabic reek. Basically, it's Middle Eastern and jazz kind of a fusion.
And that's at 7:30 tomorrow. At the same time, we must mention...
It's at 7:30. My email says 8. For more information, call 473-6054.
And sometimes we get...
get there at 7:25.
Right. I have to say, this is probably true of you, too. Let's speak about this for just 30 seconds. Both of us can probably get... the information wrong on our own, but quite often we get information wrong via the press releases.
Sometimes that is so very true.
You guys
true.
Give us the wrong time, the wrong date. Look that stuff over. It ain't easy to turn one out and make it correct. I'm telling you, we get a lot of this, and that's why we're always calling to make sure. It's either 7:30 or 8. Play it safe and get there at 7:30.
Get there at 7:25.
Yeah.
If it starts at 7:30. Well, it's not going to start at 7:30 because half of the people are going to show up late.
You show up at 7:15 for the 7:30 show, and then you find out it's 8 o'clock, you get mad.
No, but then you talk to the nice person sitting there, and it turns out that you knew each other from, 15 years ago and stuff
hey
like that.
Hey there, you sitting right next to me. Pancho Sanchez, a Latin jazz band, is also playing tomorrow
Yay.
Night. 8 p.m., Camel Rock, 10 miles north of Santa Fe. You got to pay to get in.
Pancho Sanchez plays a superb concert. I've been to many of his concerts.
Well, there you go. 8 p.m. tomorrow night at the Camel Rock. Check out www.ticketmaster.com. Also on Saturday, a fun thing that will not interrupt you going to Step It Up, Just Add Children and Watch Us Grow. This is Santa Fe Children Museum's annual fundraiser. It includes a gourmet dinner, a silent and live auction, and a flamenco performance by Maria Benitez's Next Generation Dancers. It's at 6:30 p.m. Saturday night, El Dorado Hotel, downtown, 989-8359. You do have to pay quite a bit to get in. We don't mention prices on KSFR 90.7, your most wonderful community radio station, but you can call them to find out what it's all about. And should we mention John Kerry being in town?
Sure.
He's going to be here. With his wife, signing copies of their book, This Moment on Earth. 5 o'clock tomorrow at Borders, Montezuma Avenue, no charge, 954-4707.
This Moment on Earth and Why I Ran Such a Lousy Presidential Campaign a couple years ago.
Well, that could be, but I don't know if he's going to talk about that.
Hey, tonight, Friday the 13th, DJ Timbalero will be at Salsas y Son playing salsa, merengue, reggaeton, and that is starting, well, there's a free salsa class at 8:30, and then music after that, and I can vouch for DJ Timbalero. He's a superb DJ.
I wish somebody would vouch for me once in a while. Night Mother opens tonight.
They would if they had a reason to. No, I'm just kidding. I vouch for you. I vouch for you, Robert. I really do. Night Mother is great. Have you seen it? I saw the rehearsal the other day. What are you giggling about?
I read the play. It's a fantastic play. I've actually never seen it. Ironweed Productions is tackling it with two terrific local actresses by the name of Lois Viscoli and Mona Malik. It opens at 8 p.m. tonight. El Museo Cultural once again, probably after that exhibition. 1615B, Paseo de Peralta. Here's a phone number, 660-2379. There is a story in today's Pasta Tiempo written by moi. And one other quick performance piece tonight, 7 p.m., Intersections of Self and Space. This is Institute of American Indian Arts students and faculty who have teamed up to present a multimedia performance. Art exhibit, storytelling, dance, music, film, the whole works. 7 o'clock tonight on the IAIA campus, 83 Avenue Po Road. Free. 424-2300. Easy to remember. Go ahead.
Hey, this Sunday at the College of Santa Fe, there is a sound walk. I got something from Stephen Miller. From 4:30 to 6:30 on Sunday, there is the walk to discover the sounds around you. It's a guided sound walk on the College of Santa Fe campus, led by Stephen Miller. And basically, it's an exercise in slowing down and listening to the sounds around you for about 45 minutes, and it will be preceded and followed by discussions at the O'Shaughnessy Performance Space in Benilde's Hall at the CSF campus.
You
should wear walking shoes.
Slow down, you move too fast. Yeah, that'd be a good one. 4:30, Sunday.
I believe that song is called Feeling Groovy.
Really?
Yeah, or something like that. No, actually, that's not what it's called, but that's the refrain.
I wish you'd refrain. Santa Fe Community Orchestra is playing music of Brahms, Hummel, and Rossini, featuring trumpeter Amanda Pepping, 4 p.m. Sunday at the Lenzic. At the Lenzic. There's a story in today's Pasta Tiempo. Oddly enough, they don't have a phone number for the Lenzic for this one. It's 466-4879. And we have to talk about Bill Hearn's Roadhouse Review CD release party. Sunday night, 6:30, Santa Fe Brewing Company, 27 Fireplace. Pretty cheap to get in for everybody. 6:30 to 9:30, his band, they're going to celebrate the release of his new CD, Heartache and Honky Tonks. Special guest, TBA. I never heard of that group.
To be announced.
Well, go ahead.
TBA, that's to be announced.
I hope the guy's name isn't Mark. That's the same night, by the way, that Lightning Bolt and the late Severa Wires are playing at the High Mayhem Studios.
What's wrong with Mark?
That I don't know.
He's cute.
I figured you would say that once you met him. That's why I brought him along. You could get an articulate baboon to do this show with you. And I know what you're about to say. You have an articulate baboon.
I didn't say it.
Well, you were, I bet. Rhythms, a celebration of life. I got to plug this show. It's on Tuesday, 7 p.m. at the Lenzic. Cheap to get in, and it benefits the Santa Fe High School theater program because Santa Fe High School put this show together with Joey Chavez, one of my favorite people, one of my favorite theater directors in town. He does great work at Santa Fe High. And they've put together an original musical drama about loss. And there is a phone number, 988-1234. And there's actually a piece in today's local section of the New Mexican by John Senna about this show. We didn't get to write about it in Pasta Tiempo, but please consider going to see it 7 o'clock Tuesday night at the Lenzic.
Hey, have you talked about the film Cinematographer Style, which is opening at the Santa Fe Film Center?
No, remember when that played at the film festival?
Yeah, so. I didn't get a chance to see it, but apparently for those of you who are interested in cinematography, it's a very interesting, basically, documentary about how films are made on the technical level from the point of view of cinematography, and worth going to see if that kind of thing interests you. It's really a photography brain weekend, huh?
Yeah. There's a couple of interesting lectures on Thursday night, too, and you're going to have a difficulty choosing between them. Richard Whalen is going to speak about the Oxford Challenge to the Bard of Avon. He's going to be talking about who, you know, the authorship controversy about Shakespeare, which they're going to talk about forever, and they're never going to figure it out. 7 p.m. Thursday, Vista Grande Public Library out in El Dorado. 466-7323, and it is free. Also of interest...
They should do a DNA thing on cold case files, and then they could figure it out once and for all.
I bet it was Billy the Kid that wrote all those plays.
You're probably right.
At 7 p.m. Thursday at the Santa Fe Public Library downtown, Alice Hall Petrie is going to speak about On Harper Lee, Essays and Reflections. It's going to be a lecture about the author of course, To Kill a Mockingbird. I think it's the only book the woman ever wrote. And Alice Hall Petrie is a Southern Illinois University English professor. I think this is going to be very interesting. 7 p.m. Thursday. If you like the book, if you like the movie, go down to the community room of the public library. It's free. So either go out to El Dorado for the talk about the Bard of Avon or stay in town, downtown library, for To Kill a Mockingbird. What time is it?
8:55 and a half.
Yikes. Feel like going to Abiquiú? Ghost Ranch. Piedra del Hombre Education and Visitor Center is open up on Highway 84. You can go this weekend, 9 to 5 p.m. Well, Saturday and Sunday anyway. It's no charge. They're doing the Treasures of Northern New Mexico. Also, if you're up there, Maya Art Cafe. I have not been there yet, but they've recently opened. They have a little art studio there. And Gigi Mills, Anna Karin, and Paula Nabertovsky. See, pardon me, I never mispronounce names on purpose.
On purpose. You never mispronounce names correctly, did you say?
Well, I generally...
I would beg to differ, but never mind.
I know you would, and I have a difficulty. I'm getting really accustomed to my malapropisms. I'm sorry about them, but they are part of who I am, and I actually don't make most of them up. I have a hard time with words. That's why I use a dictionary when I am writing.
That's why you're a writer.
Thank you.
And you're a good writer. Ladies and gentlemen, you should read Robert Knott's work in the Post Tiempo in every Friday in the Santa Fe New Mexican.
Thank you. I hope I'm still there. This is the weekend of the Madrid Melodrama auditions. Get down to the Madrid Melodrama at the Engine House Theater to audition for their 24th season. 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Sunday. Phone number 438-4418. Also, if you are a high school artist, the Congressional High School Art Competition is in full swing. You can compete. You have until Friday, April 27th to get this together. Original paintings, drawings, prints, photos, or mixed media work to Representative Tom Udall's office, 811 St. Michael's Drive. The final jury competition is on Saturday, May 5th at Santa Fe Place. I assume that'll be open to the public. And finally, Warehouse 21 is looking for young photographers to document the building before it is demolished. I heard a rumor as to when that's going to happen, by the way, and I'm very sad. I love that place. I hope I can do another play with them this summer, even if it's somewhere else. It's been great to see you.
It's been great to see you, too.
You look just absolutely hedonistic. How's that?
Hedonistic.
Yeah.
I don't know why you say that, but it sounds like a compliment. One is never sure. Thank you, Robert Knott.
You're welcome.
And thank you for being with us here. Tomorrow on Camp Love Wave, they're doing a program on chemtrails. I'm sorry. Okay. On Camp...
I don't blame
Robert Knott. Tomorrow on Camp Love Wave from 10 in the morning until 11. There'll be time for call-ins with your questions. Bruce Dunlap playing tonight at Gig. That's at 1808 2nd Street at 8 o'clock. And donation requested for that. What else is happening? We have no time left. Robert Knott, associate editor of the Post Tiempo Friday Art Supplement in the Santa Fe, New Mexican. Thanks for being with us here on KSFR this Friday and every Friday.
I'll be back.
You will be back. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte.
I know you.
KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. And this program can be heard any time of day by humans or other species, like kitty cats.
Yeah.
and dogs at santafe.radiocafe.org, my new website, which I'm very happy about.
Hey, it looks great.
Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services on the web at dotfoil.com. And thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering
today.
Hey,
Laurel.
Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Jazz a la Carta with Ricardo Perez and Helga Ancona playing Latin jazz, Latin music, Brazilian music,
escucha
and straight
este
ahead.
Escucha
ese programa.
Sí.
Sí.
Eso es importante.
Como no. Baila salsa. Have a good weekend.
Buenas noches, sí.
Be happy. Be peaceful. And we'll see you next week.
Okay.
The Santa Fe Radio Cafe broadcasts Monday through Friday from about 8 to 9 right here from the Santa Fe Baking Company. So keep your radio dial tuned to KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista.
Goodbye.
Ciao.